Hey guys, welcome back to the Spates Waterlead Podcast. Super grateful to have Spates on board for season four. They are obviously helping me continue to bring you some of the best lads in the game from all over the world. So super grateful to have their support. Good on you, mate. Also, the Waterlead merch is growing. Not only can you get your hands on a Waterlead tee, but also you can now get yourself your own Waterlead hoodie or Waterlead cap. I've had some great feedback on the tee so far, and wait till you try these hoodies and hats as well. If you enjoy the podcast and you want to become a lad or you just want to support, go to waterlad.com and go and get yourself some Waterlad merch. Also, the great Pure Sport are back on board, and now here on New Zealand shores, Pure Sport pride themselves on bringing together the best of science and nature. Their unique products are scientifically formulated to support mind and body well-being. I've been using their products for over 3 years now. It helps out my hip issues immensely, and I've also been taking the Mushroom Bundle recently, and I can mentally feel the difference on those. If you're keen to try some of these great products, head over to puresport.com and go check them out. What a lad. Well, man, do I have a lad for you guys here today. Let me start by saying he is widely regarded as the best ball player we've ever seen in the game. He understands rugby inside and out. He has all the skills and ability to be one of the all-time greats of the game. Yet somehow, after 18 years in the game, which included carving up the English Premiership for most of that time, it baffles me to see he's managed to pick up just 16 caps for his country. However, along the way, he's had an incredible journey on and off the field, and he's just recently released his book, Who Am I?, which is dead set the best autobiography I've ever read. He is a genuine superstar of the game, an all-time lad. Of course, it is Danny Cipriani. Welcome, mate.
Oh, mate. Did you enjoy it? That's awesome.
I loved it, mate. Honestly.
Did you really?
Genuinely. I've never read a book so fast. I've got a new PB. I just couldn't put it down. It was genuinely that good.
Oh, mate, that's really cool to hear because you're the third person outside of my inner circle that's read it. So that's really like humbling to hear. So I appreciate that, man.
Mate, yeah, how are you feeling? How are you feeling about releasing it all? Because obviously you're pretty vulnerable in it. You tell some real truth. You tell it straight. So how are you feeling about releasing it to the whole world?
Yeah, mate, I feel great. Like living in vulnerability is such a powerful thing to do. And like, from experience, you know, I haven't previously been vulnerable that much in my life because, you know, I'm playing rugby, I'm being written about, all of these things are coming to me all the time. I don't even have the opportunity to start being vulnerable. And then I met the most beautiful woman in the world who became my wife, and I got a chance to open up 60% of my heart and mind that I didn't even know existed because I was shut off in so many ways. But that vulnerability through lots of different things in my life, like, yeah, I have shown it more and more than perhaps traditional rugby players, but I guess I didn't have such a traditional route as you read about. So yeah. I think we take each individual as it comes, but rugby, in this country, we want everyone to have one size and shape fits all, but this isn't that way.
No, not at all. And it's such a good read. I've got so much on sort of the top of my head that I'm keen to try and get through in this episode. But like all Waterlad episodes, I like to start it from the start to sort of get to know you from what you're like when you first grew up. So give us the rundown for what it was like for you growing up in London.
I grew up in a council estate. So in England, council estates are like these high-rise buildings or a place where I'd say like, you know, 80 to 100 or plus more people live within an environment. They class it as working class, but my only experience of doing it was like fun and joy because I'm surrounded by lots of other little kids. You know, on the outside, we don't have as much as perhaps traditional rugby heritage type families and so on. But the beauty of it is I'm out in the field. I'm out in the cage in the back playing sport every day. Football was my first love. Just movement, just being completely engrossed in whatever I was doing, my attention, my focus, my presence. Whenever I could just focus on something which tended to be sport, it got the best out of me, and it sent me on a wild journey of where we are here today.
And you were super talented too as a kid. Like what I've read is like soccer, Chelsea wanted to sign you at 10, you were unreal at cricket, gifted rugby player, so you had all the talent. Why'd you choose rugby in the end?
Just because my two best friends played it. I went to school in Wimbledon, which is like a 30-minute bus ride away from me till I was 11. And then from 11 till 13, I had to go to boarding school for 2 years. And in those 2 years, I started taking football a bit more seriously. And Reading were coming to watch me every week in my second season. And I had a crazy season. I scored a crazy amount of goals. And then they were really wanting to sign me on a YTS for 4 years, from 14 to 18, right? But I was getting a bit homesick because I'm not a boarding school type of guy. I was very different to the rest of my crew. Like, I'm, you know, very outspoken and audacious and all of those things that people have wonderfully spoke about. but my two best mates went to school in Croydon, so I just wanted to go to school with them because I wanted to be around my best mates. I was a bit sick of being away from home, and seeing them on a Sunday just to play rugby once just didn't seem like enough for me. So I went to that school, and that was, at the time, was predominantly rugby and cricket. And then that season, rugby just started building, and it just kind of took off from there, 14 or 15.
What did you enjoy the most?
Different elements. I'd probably say overall football. Like, I play a lot of football now, just for enjoyment, because I find it so challenging to stay so calm, but yet the movement is so explosive at times. Batting in cricket, like, when I got my eye in, like, I don't think there's anything better than that. Like, just you versus the bowler, one-on-one, like, sweet shots. Like, it's real, like, domination. But then, obviously, like, I've loved my whole journey in rugby, man. I chose the best thing for me and become aligned with who I truly am and the love and light that's in me, because that's how I feel to this day. I can't go back and rewrite anything. So I'm very grateful for the whole experience.
And I guess there's one part of your sort of upbringing that you definitely spoke about in the book a fair bit, was your relationship with your parents. I know they divorced when you were pretty young, and sort of how hard that relationship was for you.
Yeah, it was tough, man. But like, at that point, you're just getting on with it. Like, if a kid's crying and you put an iPad in front of them, they forget about what they're crying about. If a kid's crying and you distract their attention, they forget. But like, ultimately, later on in life, those things come through and come out. And that's what the trauma sort of stays in your body. And that's the experience we all have through whatever our environment is growing up. And no one has it perfect. But, you know, my mum did her best in what she could. And I it caused complexities in my relationship with her. But at some point, you go back and address everything, and you release, and you just come from unconditional love. Because for me, that's the real reason why we're here, like, is to connect to love, because it's the thing that connects all of us. And also my dad, yeah, it was tough when he abandoned, well, he left at 10. So the feeling I had was that abandonment, but it was tough, but it also gave me the freedom to grow up without any constraints. I didn't have any like framework around me. I was very free, and because I had a natural excitement towards sport, I was getting all this, all these great people, from like deputy headmasters to coaches to parents, all really like showing me love and supporting me, which meant I always felt safe and looked after, because I had loads of people, you know, in my corner. So to going into sport was, you know, it was beautiful. I don't regret any part of it for a second, but it's been a hell of a ride.
And did you think you're always going to become a professional at whatever sport you did? Was that was obviously always the goal for you, but did you think it was a reality for you?
Do you know what, man? I just loved what I'd been on the field so much.
Yeah.
I was never that kid that was planning the future. I'm not an admin type of guy. I'm not like, go and do this bit. Like, I'm fully engaged in the present moment. You know, I was like that all the way till I broke my ankle and lots of stuff went on, and then kind of came away from it, but I still found it on the field, and the whole journey says it. But yeah, I wasn't looking too far in the future. So when I was young, like, I always knew I would just be playing sport, but I wasn't like, I'm going to be professional. I just didn't know how it was going to transpire. I didn't think that much.
Yeah.
And then I got signed up at Wasps at 15, and started getting a bit more serious. So I was like, okay, well, this is what I'm doing now. I didn't think it was that much of a big deal, to be honest, but yeah.
And when you eventually break through with the Wasps sort of starting side, you have a pretty incredible first year. I think you win the Heineken Cup.
Yeah.
First year in the side. Mate, what did you feel like in that season?
Oh, do you know what? It was awesome. It was awesome because I was still at school and I was playing for Wasps. I probably played about 6 or 7 games that season when I was still at school.
True.
So I made my debut at 17. So like, it was just funny, like, playing for Wasps at the weekend and then going in to school on the Monday and like just being normal. And like I was just normal with everyone. I was friends with everyone in my school. Like there was no separation. I made sure we had such a multicultural sick form. It was so great. But yeah, then that year I went turned pro. Alex King was still here, and he was a senior fly half and really understood game management. Wasn't like the most technically gifted, but really understood game management. So like made a great career and a great warrior and had lots of great attributes. But then Sean wanted me in the team because he knew that, well, from what he saw, I guess I did things a little bit unconventionally, and which caused a lot of positive outcomes for us. So he was like, look, play at fullback and I want you to mirror Alex King all year to watch what he does. But when you get the ball, just bring your explosivity and your excitement, but start learning and picking up the game management side of it from him. So like he moved me to fullback and we had a great season, man. Like we won the Heineken Cup, like my first year out of school. I don't really remember that much of it because it was just a blur of being involved, being completely locked into it. But yeah, it was great.
And then straight from that season, you're basically into the English camp. Is that right?
Yeah. So I started training with England when I was still at school. I was 18, but then I wasn't like playing for England then. Yeah. I was just brought in to train. And then at the end of that season, I was brought in for the like, pre-World Cup in 07 for like 3-4 months. And it was like, what a slog it was, man. But what an amazing experience too. Like it was a lot of fun. And then that following year, Alex King left Wasps and I moved to 10 because that was always the plan. Mm. And yeah, we won the Premiership the next year. So it was like... coming at me, made my debut for England, like, you know, all sorts was going on.
Yeah, and that debut start for England in particular was, I guess, the one where you really stood up on the international scene against Ireland, put on an absolute clinic. Everyone was calling you the saviour of England rugby and, mate, you had everything, I guess, in front of you. How did you feel after that game?
Mate, like, I was happy and excited, but I always just felt like it was going to happen. Like I felt like that was the route. I felt like that was what was in my forecast. I felt so comfortable out there. You know, that coach gave me the license to run training all week and, you know, dictate the way I wanted to play, because I'd known Brian since I was 15 by being in the National Academy. So he knew my intellect towards rugby and my understanding. So and they had been a bit like hit and miss in the attack. So I went in and I was just like, I'm 20. Like, what do I do here? Like, how do I front foot this? I didn't even have those questions. But the first thing I did is I took meetings and I was like, look, this is what we're doing. This is how we're doing it. You're going here. However it was, this is the simplicity of what we're doing. And everyone probably was so taken back and everyone just did it. And then we had a great performance. But yeah, there's only been 2 games in my career the coaches have let me run the week, and that was one.
All right. How did you get the confidence to be able to stand up in front of England as such a young kid to tell everyone what to do? Like, you often hear of young guys going into environment like that and just being right down the back, you know, completely not saying anything, but you just being able to get up there, dominate a meeting, dominate the game plan, dominate the week and the performance. Pretty incredible.
Mate, when I was 14, I remember I was playing my mate, who's now a professional cricketer. His name's Laurie Evans, and he was a good rugby player. He was playing scrum half. And his dad's a lovely guy, and his dad's super passionate about his son doing well. And obviously, I recognise that now. But when I was 14, his dad would just shout at him on the sidelines all the time. Mm. But I could see when he was shouting at his son, it was making Laurie make poor decisions and like hesitate, because he wouldn't hesitate normally. And at that point, I'm in the middle of the game. We've got about 400 people watching. I've turned around. I said, would you shut the fuck up and let Laurie play? Like, that might not be the done thing for a 14-year-old to do. And you ask, why was I able to do that? I think, you know, as much as I felt the loss of my father, I also didn't feel that I had to impress a man or someone ahead of me. And I think that relationship, when you've got a strong, stern father, at some point, you know, biologically, you know, in history, even in the animal kingdom, there comes a time when it's a bit tension you have to sort of surpass. I never had that experience. So when I was in that environment, I was just being me, and Brian loved it. So I ran with it.
So you were never intimidated going into the environments. I know you were never really intimidated by coaches You seem to clash heads a fair bit with them throughout your career, but you always, especially even going into England, you felt really comfortable, confident in who you were.
Yeah, yeah. But on the rugby field, I am, man. Like,
yeah.
On the sports field, that's, you know, that's where I got everything I ever wanted. Like, as a child, even if I'm feeling certain things at home, or if I was getting, like, rejected at home, or, you know, I felt lost, or I wasn't feeling safe at home, being in the sports field, I felt alive. So that's why I just kept going to it and kept taking to it. And yeah, I just, it's just where I was. It was my happy place, man. It's the thing that has brought me to the most beautiful place in my mind, body and soul ever, to this current date. It's definitely been, as you read, a lot of ups and downs throughout it.
Yeah, you mentioned being on the field was your happy place, but there's a fair amount going on off it as well. So obviously, there's not much paparazzi here in New Zealand. There's a few keyboard warriors, but there's no real media like you guys get over there. I've never seen a player sort of dragged through the paparazzi media like you have through your career. I guess that started sort of after that England game, a few celebrity relationships too.
Yeah, it was a bit before, the week before. I went to give tickets on a Wednesday to a friend who was in a nightclub. I was on the way back from my physio and I got snapped coming out, and then I got dropped from playing fullback against Scotland the week before that Ireland game.
Yeah.
And then it just, like, even though I'd been written about a lot considering rugby players before that, that kind of just took it off. And then, as you mentioned, I had certain girlfriends in the public eye, and that just let them run with it, really.
And how'd you find it, or how'd you find being thrown through that media like that?
Man, if you asked me at different points in my life, you'd have had very different answers. Like, the beauty of being able to reflect at this point and being present and centre is, you know, I look back with everything with a loving light and a learning lesson or an experience or wisdom that I've learned from. When you're in the ringer of it and the emotional turmoil and you don't know who you are and you're figuring that out and you're being judged and critiqued for snippets of your life, and that doesn't align with who your soul is or what you want to do in life, but you're behaving impulsively because there's lots of things, like I said, from childhood that are coming through me in some of my behaviours, which are all my responsibility. But, you know, I was completely emotionally unavailable to women, but yet that the toy and the play with it, the flirtation and the, they just warmed to me. They warmed to me. It wasn't an effort. I wasn't like manipulating. They just warmed to me. But yeah, I was so emotionally unavailable, which probably tells you a lot, you know, like when a man's emotionally unavailable, a bit mysterious, like women tend to flock to that. And I'm reflecting in hindsight, but when I'm in it, I'm just behaving as such, like, because, you know, if you've got a young daughter, you don't want her to be with someone who's emotionally unavailable, because it's just going to be a rocky road, you know?
Yeah. But,
you know, it was interesting because it took me out of myself a lot. It sent me into really being confused. I had a lot of my validation externally, because even as a young kid, as I explained, I went and played sport. I was happy on the field. I was getting all this praise and everyone saw me for who I was, who I felt I was in my soul. So then I felt great about it. But then at this point, now I'm also getting external validation, but now it's negative. So I'm feeling it in the same manner. Not that my ego ran with it, but I'm getting all this negativity and I'm wearing it. And it took me into a place of just like really soul seeking and searching. And what's so beautiful is life, the universe put the most amazing people in front of me at different points in my life so I could learn some amazing bits of their wisdom and love and light, because, you know, I wouldn't call my mum and dad if something was going wrong. I didn't have that, but the universe brought amazing people into my world who I was able to lean on and, you know, provide me some insight or knowledge within certain times, or even just sit with me and see me for who I really was. And those people were invaluable to me because it really kept me going in loads of different ways.
And you speak about sort of the woman and your relationship with women, and sort of one part that definitely blew me away around your book was your squad of women, like 20 to 30 women going, you know, sometimes three a day, threesomes were normal. It was like incredible. A lot of men would just look at that and say, like, you are living the absolute dream. Yeah. But what's it like being actually in there?
It's so far from the truth. Like, yeah. The moments are fun. Like the moments of the physical contact of what sex is and the play, that's fun. But again, throughout a day, you know, that might last an hour or so. You know, I've got a bit of stamina, it might last an hour or so. But the rest of your day, you're feeling completely like it's a high you're trying to continuously get all the time. Yeah. But yet it's stemming from a place not of like purity and love and joy. It's actually stemming from a place of like a need of that validation or that feeling or being seen or that love that you think is love that I've got no idea about. Mm. That I'm diving into the whole time without anyone going, well, no, this is not what, you know, not that anyone, well, no one did was like come and speak to me about it. Because I guess I'm not sharing that with people because everyone, like you say, in the rugby world thinking, oh, yeah, well, he's the man. Like, well, it's not. Like any person that behaves like that is a lost soul, man. And anyone that behaves in that manner with so many different broads. And my only correlation to it is I've met the love of my life and I've met someone who I've opened up to fully. Warts and all, soul and all, everything, top to bottom. And the feeling I have every day in love, in light, with her, it doesn't even compare to how I was behaving previously. So all of those ways of behaving from the outside is all ego, man-made, thinking it's great. Like, it's nothing, man, compared to what committing your life is to one woman and going on that journey and someone you truly love and turning up for her every day. And that sensation is so much greater. There's no up and down. There is just a state of joy for me. And that's what I commit to in my work. With what I study and what I look at and but also just how I live my life.
So good. And I remember your story about like your first girlfriend. I wonder if that had an effect on you and the rest of your girlfriends. I think you're 18, she was 30. You tell her you don't want to be with her anymore and it's all pretty dramatic.
Yeah, that it could, it, do you know what, it could have in hindsight because that experience there was like far out, man. I've said what I want to say here and she now wants to hurt herself, so I kind of stopped doing that and I let people down way more gently, but in doing so it probably kept people a bit more attached to me in a way, so they probably felt a bit like that's probably why people sold stories on me, because they probably felt the emotional connection of some form or matter. But when I look back, maybe that was something to do with it, but who knows.
So did she just jump out of the car? Is that what happened?
Tried to. She took her belt off. She went to open the door and I stopped her and I pulled over and I was like, what are you doing? But, you know, I don't judge that, because for whatever reason, whatever happened in her life, that was the way she felt to behave and react. It just, I guess, threw me off a bit in terms of saying, look, no, I don't want to be with you here because that's what happened. Like, I didn't want to see that again.
Yeah. And it must have been a fair bit of admin for you. Like, you talk about trying to not hurt anyone's feelings and, you know, sort of keep the whole squad happy. Like, fair bit of admin for you off the field.
It wasn't. Like, and I say it so frivolously in the way I say squad, but, like, I say that as a joke.
Yeah, I get that.
You know, my teammates would be like, oh, no, I would just say it as a joke because I didn't want to speak about names or details, so I just kept it as that. But yeah, you know, I had a lot of people that I guess I slept with for a long time over the years. And, you know, I met a lot of great people during it too. But, you know, there's nothing that can compare to meeting the love of your life.
Yeah.
Like, it is like a drop in the ocean of what it truly is. And, you know, I share these experiences which, you know, are vulnerable and open. And over here, you should see the media now, man. They're going nuts. Like, they're taking snippets of the book, as you can imagine, and just posting that as the story, which is now, like, everyone's like, fucking, he's an asshole. Like, well, you know, read the book. It's different. But at the end of the day, that's just how the media play. That's what they do. I've understood the way they narrate and create stories. But, yeah, the whole journey, man, like, man, it's been fun.
Yeah. And let's get back on the field. Like you spoke about it before, but you had a pretty bad break and dislocation of your ankle just when you were flying. Bad timing. Yeah. How was that for you to deal with, especially mentally?
Yeah, do you know what? Mate, my ankle was flipped round. My bone was coming out my foot.
Oh, I hate those.
It felt like really bad cramp. And then I looked at my foot, and it felt like really bad cramp in my ankle.
Yeah, that's bad cramp.
And I looked at my foot, and then my brain goes, nah, this is how you're meant to feel. And the pain goes, vroom. And I was just like, like that. I was worried because they originally thought that I might not play again. There was all whispers. But then my physio, who is an absolute angel of a human, he's the best out there. He was in the surgery with the surgeon because he can help with surgery and so on. And as soon as I woke up, he was like, the healing was great. The alignment was great. You're going to be fine. As soon as he said that, even that day, I didn't really feel pain apart from when he treated it. When he treated it, it was the worst pain ever. It was worse than breaking it, breaking down the scar tissue and getting that all out, like all of that stuff. But, you know, for me, I've always used injuries as a chance to like just better myself in some form, some way. Because someone said to me, like, when you get injured for a couple months or a long period when you're young, it does seem like the end of the world, but it puts years on at the end of your career. Like, playing rugby and training is taxing, especially over here. I don't know what your training routine's like, but here they just flog the boys. There's no real thought behind it. It's just, you see the boys at the weekend play for England now, and everyone's like, they're unfit. I'm like, no, they're tired.
Yeah.
They're tired. I know what it's like. They overexert and train when ultimately you want to hold a bit back, so when they come out on Saturday, you're out the traps. Do you know what I mean? Mm. But rugby doesn't understand that concept. It's all about hit the nail into the ground as often as possible over here. But, you know, it doesn't always win the race. So injuries for me were a chance to recalibrate, reconfigure, like better some other part of my body, you know, just settle down.
How are England going to change that? It's such an interesting point around the mindset going into the weeks, and how are they going to change that?
I think they have to employ people who do it very differently. I think not employing Scott Robertson, like whether it was now or later, you know, that's something they probably need to look to do, because from speaking to him and from what you said, he's got a completely different outlook to rugby. And you see that. You see people in the way people move, man. Mm. Like, people in New Zealand aren't necessarily better athletes than people here, but yet they look fresher and more able to be more fluid and looser. But that's not through their physical capabilities. That's also through a relaxation of the mind, of being present, of being and allowed to go and express yourself. Because being allowed to express yourself and playing through joy means you're naturally more fluid in movement. You see it within football. You see it within Steph Curry. You see it within top athletes.
Yeah.
There's a flow. There's a movement to it. Whereas here, our culture and our sport is very much like, must do it, prove it over and over again. Like, go harder. If you don't go harder, go even harder tomorrow. Like, keep working. Because, like, that's the answer. But if that was the answer, then life would be so easy if it was just to keep working. But do you think we're put on this earth to just keep working? We're here to find joy, find love. So if you play in that expression, you're only ever going to see more fluid, more lucid and better movement. Like, it's the highest energy to play to. But, you know, our culture here, you know, it's just kind of not steeped in that, really, especially in rugby. And I guess it's kind of proven over the years, them not picking people like Christian Wade or Sam Simmons or people that would have played for the All Blacks. Like, Christian Wade's the best winger I've ever seen with the ball in hand. True, like, there's no one that can do what he can do. And I'm not saying it from a biased perspective. I'm looking at, like, there's obviously some other phenomenal wingers that you guys have got, like, but in terms of getting out of a phone box, you're doing it without anything on your shirt.
Yeah, you're right. It's interesting, eh? It's such a fascinating situation and comparison between the two nations. But is that why you sort of went over to Melbourne and gave Super Rugby a go?
No, so I went there because Martin Johnson said I wasn't in his plans for England. So I was like, I'm not going to bang my head against the wall for the next 3 years before the World Cup. Because I only played rugby to play for England really when it started happening, because I wanted to be the best. Like, I wanted everyone to see me as the best. So And that also stems from a lack of too. That's like there's something for me to want to be seen and go on that journey and go through all this turmoil and the ups and downs to feel like I'm the best is also from some place of not feeling good enough too. Because if you feel good enough and you just play from joy and fun and freedom, then you don't have that necessarily drive. It might just happen. Like you put the effort and the work in, which obviously comes with it. But yeah, I went to Melbourne because Super Rugby was the first competition I ever watched on TV, and the Wellington Hurricanes were the first team I ever watched. And I used to watch Christian Cullen, Umaga, Alatini, Howell, Lomu, Rodney Suialu, Jerry Collins. You know, who's the tall ginger lot?
Paul Tito, mate. You're a true Hurricane fan.
Paul Tito. Yeah, that was my team, man. Like when I was a kid, so I didn't know anything about English rugby. I just wake up on Saturdays and watch Christian Cullen just cut everyone a new one.
Oh man, he was gifted, eh, man. He could just slice through the D like no one else,
mate. Yeah,
and I remember reading one quote that really stood out to me was like Melbourne seemed like a better option than putting a gun to your head. Like,
yeah,
that's how deep it was for you, wasn't it? Because there was a moment leading up to that where it did get pretty dark and heavy for you.
Yeah, it did. It was dark and heavy because, you know, I'd walk down the street and, you know, I would see people look at me, and people wouldn't be subtle. So like if they see someone they know, they like double take again. And it's not like a bad fault of theirs, but if you see someone you kind of recognize, you might think, you know them, I get it. Like, and I'd always get that. And then you'd hear people go, "That's Cipriani." And like, I'm literally 1 meter away. I can hear people saying it. So like, I just felt that with a lot of places I went to. My brain would go straight to negativity. Mm. It would go straight to, they're saying something negative about me, because that's all I read. That's all I saw. That's all people were saying. So I was basing how I felt or myself on the outside world, but it didn't align with who I was. So I felt so conflicted.
Yeah.
I was just in a place where I felt so claustrophobic. I couldn't go anywhere. Like I wouldn't be able to phone, you know, my nearest family members and tell how I'm feeling, because the response I would get would be quite an aggressive one back. So I just, you know, not from my dad as much, but that was just the way it was. So I felt very alone. Like I grew up alone. Yeah. I also felt alone in my dark times too, you know. But yeah, divine intervention, lots of things happened, didn't go that way. And I did go to Melbourne, and you know, I probably didn't, when I was in Melbourne, give my best efforts, because when I went there with all the intention to do so, thinking Rod McQueen's a World Cup winning coach, you know, rugby's going to be great over there. I had all these fantasies about Super Rugby. And then I went over there and I realised they're English with an Aussie accent. Like, this is not expansive, free-flowing rugby. So straight away, I was just kind of like, fuck it, I'm in Australia. I didn't really drink alcohol to that point.
True.
I'm going to start hanging out with my teammates and have some fun. Like, you know, it was a well-paid gap year, it felt like.
Yeah, I laughed when you said around the move Apple, which was the 15-man pick and go. Like, you've come to play some expensive Super Rugby, man. And your coach is coming up with a 15-man pick and go that they score on you.
What I love about rugby, and the same would happen in England. If a coach said that in England, people would just do it, right?
Yeah.
But what I love about rugby is I'm there going, you can't be for real with this. And everyone's saying it, but no one says anything.
Yeah.
So I'm like, and, you know, like I said, at 20, I went and led the team. At 22, I'm still not going to be afraid to say I'm not going to do it in a derogatory manner. But when he's like, "Danny, why are you not getting involved in the pick and go?" I said, I'm not taking part in that, mate. There's no evidence or anything that this is going to be efficient play. Like, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
And you've got people like Sterling Mortlock going, "Come on, Danny, mate, just give it a go." I'm like, "Sterling, you know this is shit, so why are we doing it?" And we're like, "But yet I'm trouble." Yeah. "Nah, I'm just standing up for what I believe in. Like, give me some understanding of why you think it's going to work." And then the first play against the Tars, turn the ball over, Curtly Beale goes the length. I didn't get to start the first game because I wouldn't do Apple. It was mad.
Yeah, so true though, eh? Like, when players don't believe in something, they just complain in the sheds. But you're obviously different. You were willing to go straight to the coaches, as you should, and have a genuine discussion around the best option.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, do you know what? I was still learning the game at that point, like the ins and outs, the nooks and crannies of it. Like my ability on the ball was I could do whatever I wanted, but I now need to configure, how do I get everyone around me understanding that too? So I had those couple of years at Melbourne learning a lot. I learned a lot from Andrew Johns, ball playing wise. I had a great little group with like Curtly and James. You know, we did lots of extra training, and Richard Kingy and Cooper Vuna. We had a great little group, Peter Beetham, Afisipa Tamiopiao. Yeah, it was great. And then I went to Sale for my first year when I got back from England, and I let the coach run the team again, and we almost got relegated. And after that season, I was like, I'm not letting my career be in the mercy of another man's vision. Like, unless what they say aligns and I feel what he's saying. Because when it comes to effective ball play, it's not whimsical. There's a flow to it. There's a way to do it. There's a way to commit defenders. There's a way to understand what's happening. Rugby is the same as basketball and football in terms of it's attacking space. It's how you pull defenders out. Basketball's very much all in front of you. There's a 360 element to it when you get to the D. Football is a 360 game. Rugby's 180, much more linear. So it's just about moving the pieces. And for me, if the formation, the framework doesn't align up to that, creating numerical advantages, then you're just playing 50-50 all the time, running into people. And I'm not saying there's not a place for it. Like, people think, oh, you just want to throw the ball about. It's not the case. You look at someone like South Africa and they're deep rooted in culture and tradition. You see how connected they are as a group. Like, I went and saw Willie LaRue the other day before they played New Zealand.
Oh, yeah.
Mate, 2 days before, the calmness, the way that everyone hugs everyone. There's a real connection there that's so powerful. That's more powerful than a game of rugby. And you feel that on the field when they take it on there, when you take it out there. Like, there's no bravado, there's no macho. They are that. They live it. It's different. Whereas in England, we have this, got to look like you're wearing the right jumper and you're saying the right thing and you're talking in the right voice. Like, how do you connect to that? Like, yeah. For me, you know? And yeah, that's, I don't even know what the point was, but that's what we're going down to.
You've nailed it. But did you speak about the sort of cultures and stuff. You would have fit in quite well with a few of those lads in the Melbourne Rebels, the Curtly Beals, James O'Connor, especially at that young time, man, of yours.
Yeah, we was a bit loose then. We was a bit loose.
And you mentioned you didn't drink until you got over there.
Yeah, not really.
You found prescription grubs as well? The tramadols?
Oh, mate, like, it was so apparent everywhere in Oz. Like, you know, Aussies are like English people. Like, they love to drink. And you imagine if England was sunny 9 months of the year, I don't think we'd get anything done as a nation. Hence why Aussies don't get anything done. Like, they're 9 months a year of getting pissed. Like, they're the same as us and them. Like, that's the culture of what it is. Yeah. And I don't drink that so rarely as a celebration. I don't like it. It's depressing. It pulls me down. It's not anything that I enjoy. But it really is embedded in our culture here. And I find it mad, because if you go back to 1970, whenever they made alcohol legal, right? And if they brought it to this current day and go, this is what it is. This poison here is going to make you behave potentially like A, B or C. Is it going to be FDA approved? Everyone would be like, mate, that sounds like a horror drug.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's accepted now because it's just been around for so many years. Like, it does a lot more worse than good.
And what about prescription drugs as well? Because I see that in the game still, like, it's still a massive part of it. People dropping back the tramadols just to sort of get through. What's your thoughts on it?
Do you know what? I think it used to be really easy accessible over here.
Yeah.
And also when I was in Oz, they're stricter with it now because tramadol itself has become an enlisted drug, so there needs to be more of a protocol behind getting it. But I used to enjoy the feeling of like just being numbed, because I was wanting to not be in my mind. Like, when I was taking it, I felt like I could be a little bit freer and enjoy my days a bit more. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's such a bad road to go down. But I never at one point felt like I was addicted to it. I never wanted to label myself addicted to anything, because then that's another hurdle you've got to overcome. You've just got to figure out why, where it's coming from. Like, what are you trying to hide? What are you trying to replace? What are you trying to numb or get rid of? But yeah, I get it at times. It's fun too. But, you know, in terms of the long term, being on this planet and feeling the full effects of life and what's available to you. You don't want to numb yourself down to it. You need to feel it. You need to feel every emotion. You need to not be afraid to letting it out, letting it go, especially as men, because, you know, you're brought up in a different manner, but being able to express emotion at any point, you know, it gives you a full flavor of life. It doesn't mean you're going to be an emotional guy, but if you are able to express it from a young age, then you're going to be able to handle very emotionally difficult scenarios in a much clearer, calmer manner. For me, you know, it was a means to an end, but yeah, it was something I partook in.
What's the key to that? What's the key to, especially with younger guys, to, I guess, helping them be able to express themselves?
I think the most difficult thing when you love someone, like be a child or, you know, anyone you love, is seeing them in pain, like, because you want to take it away from them. So you want to be like, it's going to be okay, don't worry, you're going to be all right, come on, let's keep going.
Yeah.
Right? Like, just being there is sometimes enough, like, because you're actually stopping that sensation for that kid or playing out that whole process of what's happening, of crying, of, mate, it's our natural instinct. Like, and it sounds so, you don't just sit back and go, or cry out, you fucker. Like, I'm not saying to do that. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Be present, be there, try and get down on the level, find out how things are going. But don't try and stop their experience of what they're feeling at a young age, because even though they might be emotional children, they're going to be much more emotionally stable adults. But I know a lot of parents who see kids that cry when you're out in public or you're out with things, you want to hush your child up because you don't want people to think you've got a cryy kid. But yeah, mate, it don't fucking matter. Yeah. Like, anyone who thinks that about them is completely forgets being a baby themselves. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. No, that is good advice and good reminder for all the parents out there. But you eventually moved back to the UK. You moved back to Sale, like you spoke about, and that was purely to chase your England dream again.
Yeah, man. It was awesome. I went back to Sale, wanted to play for England. Went to a very, like, hard-nosed northern club. The first year was absolutely hideous because I was, like, just letting the coach run the team. And I'm still figuring things out. But then I was just, next year, I met my mentor at the end of that season and things changed. And I just found a way to play the game, but not just exciting for myself. My whole rest of my career was spent giving new perspectives to other players and giving them an understanding of just giving them a bit more time on the ball. Like, I never did anything for them. They did it all. But I just gave them a few pointers of positioning or foot speed or certain little bits. So when they did want a ball play, they were fully in control of what they were doing. And I used to love doing that because it was such small minor things that I'd experienced myself. But then sharing that insight, you can then see they're getting the ball and they've got all this time to make great decisions. They're not rushed with a pass. You know, they understand they're committing defenders. And then it was just like, I just really enjoyed the aspect of my career. And I spent the majority of my time doing that.
And then you moved to the WAS. I think you spoke about it around it, basically to give yourself the ability to play the style you wanted to at Sale. So going to WASP was basically around that, was it?
I just missed out on the World Cup selection. And everyone that was getting picked was in a top four team. So I thought, okay, I've got to go to one of those teams. Like, and WASP were like third or fourth the year before. I was going to go to Quinn's, but I met Di and he told me that he wanted me to come run his attack.
Yeah.
And I said to him in the meeting, I went, you want me to run the whole attack? Do you know what that means? And he's like, no, I want you to do it. I was like, okay. So then get to WASPs, and after like X amount of weeks of pre-season, I'm not playing in the first pre-season game.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't get, you want me to come and do this? And he just didn't like the fact, I guess, that I was taking eyes off him. Like, there's such a control element here. But I'm on the field with the boys and I want to upskill everyone or give someone, not upskill, but I want everyone to be the most efficient they can be in every position as possible within a framework which suits everyone. But yeah, we had this preseason game. We were playing the team that just got promoted. We were losing with 20 minutes to go and he put me off the bench and we ended up winning the game. And then he started me in every game ever since because the need to win for him was more important than his ego. So that's kind of what happened.
And you mentioned a little bit around missing out on England, and I guess that was pretty much the story of your career, like playing really good footy but never getting an opportunity really to make yourself a true international player on the big stage. So
yeah.
Talk about missing out on that World Cup. How hard was that one for you?
Yeah, man, do you know what? I wouldn't say I sat with it for long thinking it was hard, because I was in a place where I was working through a lot, and I was accepting whatever comes my way. Like, that's how I handle being present. And
yeah.
I still had lots of frustration around it. But going into the World Cup, I had a storm in rehearsal, like in 17 minutes. And then they didn't pick me. So I was like, okay, that's how it is. And I look back at, you know, Martin Johnson's reign, it wasn't deemed successful. And Stuart Lancaster's reign wasn't deemed successful. And Eddie Jones's reign wasn't deemed successful. And they all didn't pick me. Well, they did sporadically. But, you know, my inclusion with England from 2014 onwards, I didn't have a bad game or a bad moment. You know, I remember in 2018, Eddie Jones, the legend, picked me. He picked me. They'd lost 7 games in a row, yeah, and he picked me to play against Africa. It was pissing it down, like the worst torrential rain ever. Yeah. And, like, just not my day. But I stayed within it, 70 minutes in, you know, chasing box kicks, making my tackles, doing what I had to do. But then as soon as I had a moment to do something, I did it, just impulsively, instinctively, and we scored and we won the game. And like, I stop his losing streak, and then I don't make the squad again for like a whole year. I'm like, oh my days, this guy is just, he just don't like me.
Yeah, why do you think that is? Why do you think those sort of three coaches, or any England coach, hasn't got along with you or hasn't liked you?
It's tough. It's tough. Yeah. It's tough to say, because like, I'm then speaking for them, but I can only speak on the people they pick and the leadership groups they create. And there's a lot of great men in there. I'm not remotely ever. The thing is, when I speak, it's not anyone's person. It's not anyone's soul.
Yeah.
It's just from the behaviours that they display. And I don't take that as them, because we all want to be better. We all want to try our best. We all want to come from love. But a lot of people's life experience don't allow you to do it. And, you know, I've been judged to high heel. So why am I going to go back and spit that judgment into the world? So I only speak about what I see in a leadership format. And Martin Johnson, Stuart Lancaster and Eddie all selected people who would do as they say, who would execute what they want. And I think around me, there's a certain element of uncertainty as a coach, because, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm in the moment. Like, I don't want to know it, because then you don't know until you're in the moment. Yeah. Like, that uncertainty for them made them feel like maybe out of control, or like I was a risk. Like, playing for England was easier than playing club rugby for everyone.
Beautiful.
Because you're playing with the best players,
yeah,
with all the same mindset, with the most perfect nutrition, with the most perfect environment. But in England, where they get it catastrophically wrong, is they hype everything up. They make it the biggest occasion, the biggest thing. You're representing your country. Da-da-da-da-da. You can say that all out there in the media, and you can hype up a fight like they do in the UFC. But come game day, you want to be joyous and calm and able to do anything you want. You don't want to coach in that fashion. They don't understand that. We see the fanfare, the excitement of fighters when it comes to UFC and what they speak about. And it feels like they want to kill each other. It's just a way to sell the fight.
Yeah.
In their training, it's all about staying fluid, relax your shoulders, pop it out. Like, you can't go into a fight wanting to kill someone. You're going to get knocked out by these absolute artists at what they do. We think hard work's going to solve it all, and it's not really the case.
When you say you like going to the line, or you don't like to preempt anything, obviously you're one of the best decision makers at the line in the game. Are you going at that line with no preconceived ideas? You're just always taking it to the line with all options available?
You're reading lots at different points. There's different points on the field. From a 15-metre line, if there's a ruck and you're going long side and there's a ruck, you know they're going to fold 3-2 in the ruck, 5-2 in the backfield, 7. They could have 8, maybe 7 with a sweeper, right? So you roughly know numerically where people are going to be. You can check people folding, people moving and things around. Like, you're scanning, you have that awareness. You also recognise at times they might overstack alongside. So if I've got the ball and I'm in the middle of the field and I'm playing to the left and I know the defence is heavily stacked, rather than make like the best decision I can. I'll make the most efficient one, which will be, all right, if I play short here, attract defenders, they'll still fold the same amount because in the heat of the battle, teams get their folds mixed up. I know we're going to go this way, we'll get you. So you're kind of always aware of what's going on around you. But then obviously when you get the ball and you go at the line and you commit and you go deep into the line, into that space of uncertainty, when you're at the line ready to play, I'm just focused on defenders' hips and shoulders and their body shapes. But I also know when I move with a certain speed, what it's going to do, I don't really look at the guy in front of me. It's like the guy next to me and the one after that. And I know if I move at a certain speed that they're going to be rooted and attracted in certain ways, especially if I've got my team locked and loaded in the right positions on inside shoulders, taking people on. You can have certain players like your brother, Tommy Marshall, where, you know, he would just read my body shape. So I knew with him, if I'm going square, but I kick out on one, he's just going to follow me and do it. But not every player has that intuition at that moment to do it. So you also have to play to the players around you. And that doesn't mean anyone's better or worse. Everyone's got different strengths. Those more physical guys, they want to be more on top of people. Mm. But, you know, there's lots of players I've played with that had finesse that were big too. When it comes to going to the line and doing that, you commit and you train and you learn what it feels like to go deep into it and play as late as possible. But that doesn't mean every time. Doing the right thing means each situation is slightly different and you play to it accordingly. That's how I do it.
Mate, I love it. True insight into the absolute wizard at playing the ball at the line.
No, I don't know about that.
But one thing I did love about your sort of story was your resilience to, I guess, keep striving for that England jersey. You obviously had big offers from France regularly, Japan, but you just kept pursuing this England dream, no matter how unlikely it was with the certain coaches. You just keep trying to break them down.
Yeah, do you know what? I was, and like, you know, the whole time my character was getting assassinated. Like, in 2015, coaches would be like, you're not in the squad every single day. You don't know what people's characters are like. They would always lean into that element of things with me because it was easy, because that narrative was already built. So they could say that about me. But that was just a way to protect them from not picking me at times. Yeah. But I was wearing all of that. Like, you're doing this so you can pick who you want to pick. But I've got to go home and deal with the fact that everyone now listens to what you say because you're the coach. And people are now assuming I'm this bad character. Mm. And having to always keep going in those moments is like where I learned to really know myself. But I also have, which I, you know, when I look back in my life, the times I would get up and keep going and keep playing and keep turning up, like there's something deep within every single person, like an energy, a power. There's something where if you connect to the faith of it, that does keep you going, that keeps us protected, because the reason why we're here is unexplainable. It's all magical in that sense. Like, we can't know for certain. Mm. You can't know for fact. So for me, that thing would always drive me. I was determined to like learn my psyche, myself in every single way, and just not bow down to these people that were saying X, Y, and Z to me because it didn't align with me. It didn't feel right. Yeah. It didn't feel right the way that the game was coached, the way the game is ran. It didn't feel right to me the way that all of that stuff in this country. But it's now coming to fruition that way. Mm-hmm. Like, we've just lost three premiership teams. English rugby is at its lowest ebb. Everything is crumbling because of this facade of, we've got to keep doing the right thing and must look like we're doing the right thing. Like, it's actually fear. That's you leading in fear. Like, committing to the truth and love means that you commit to doing the right thing in the moment. And sometimes it could be messy. Sometimes it could be whatever it is. Mm. So for me, it was just always connecting to like myself as much as I could. And I met some great people who, you know, I learned meditation from like over about 10 years ago. And man, I've been on such an interesting journey, which has brought me to this day. And still, even now, like, I've got the whole nation judging me based on extracts from my book. Like, you know, some of the stuff people are saying is so ludicrous, but, you know, it's from their perspective, from what they see. And some of it's also fair. Like, yeah, you can make that judgment, but you're now making a judgment on something 13 years ago. Like,
yeah,
that's not the story. That's, if we judge people on moments in time in the past, when do we ever move forward? Mm. if we judge moments of time in the past, then we stay rooted in racial discrimination. We stay rooted in religious segregation. We can only allow people to keep moving forward and keep proving and allowing people to grow and express and come from love, right? And that is every single message I ever want to deliver. That's everything that I want to stand up for in every single way, shape or form, because I know so many athletes get so much critique on social and it can affect their mental health and so on. And I've been in that position where I've felt the weight of it. But until you learn your internal and know yourself from a loving place, because if you've got malicious behaviours or, you know, if you, you know, doing things that are self-toward or self-gain or negative in that way, you can't live in a clear spirit or a clear light. So for me, it's just about cleaning up yourself, where you're coming from, because everyone wants to be love and light. You know, our life takes us away from that through different experiences. But always connecting to that and rooting to that is how I live my days. And that is what keeps me in the faith and the joy of spreading the message from my book. So I'm able to hopefully just share that with England, because you guys probably get a lot more of it in New Zealand, but over here we don't. You know, and I've been in the middle of the media storm and they're posting things now which are causing people, like I said, to react in certain ways. But I just want to shine a light on it all, really, to spread the word of love, bro.
Mate, I love it. So powerful. And sort of why I asked you at the start, like how you're feeling about releasing it, because obviously throughout your career, any time you made an error or you stuffed up, it was fully, they twisted it to make you out to the villain. And I can only imagine what they're going to, you've seen it from these snippets already, you're saying that they're going to just take any little bit out of this book and try and, I guess, stick to that narrative.
Yeah, they are. I understand the reaction, but for athletes, you know, I would love every athlete to understand this, right? If you squeeze orange juice, if you squeeze an orange, orange juice comes out. If you squeeze a human and they tweet hate, that's what comes out of them. You wouldn't eat a bad orange, would you? You wouldn't take on the nutrients of a bad orange. You'd just throw it away. So anyone that spits that type of anger, don't even take it on. And I know it's easier said than done. But that's how I now view it, because I would never openly say negativity in that way to someone else. But in England, the original trolls, the original keyboard warriors are our tabloids and newspapers, and they have a license to do and say what they want, right? And it affected me at my point really to a core, and they kept me accountable along the way. But through my book, I want to keep them accountable, because I lost someone who is a beautiful light in this world. I didn't lose them. The world lost them. Their mum lost them, their sister, their friends, because of this hate that they spit continuously. She didn't feel like she could keep going on, and she ended up taking her own life. So that is one of the biggest driving forces, that I will continue on this line of love and light, because ultimately I made it out. I was able to, and she hasn't. So I know she'd be proud of me for taking the steps that I am. And, you know, I'm going to stick it to the man, and that's the best thing I can say. I'm going to just reveal to themselves what's what, because it's just not acceptable. It's not acceptable in this modern day.
And you speak about that moment, obviously would have been the most toughest moment of your life was when you found out that news that Carolyn had taken her life. How hard was that for you to deal with?
Man, like, you don't ever get over it.
No.
Like, it's within. Like, I was sat on a Friday night about to play a game and she tried to call me.
Yeah.
And I couldn't answer. And I texted her and I can't speak. I'm in the changing room. I didn't know the levels where she was at. She didn't explain to me. She was that far down the line. She was always asking inquisitive questions. And then I play a game of rugby. And then I find out the next day she's dead. And I'm thinking, for a game of rugby, I couldn't answer the phone. Like, I know, like, it's not my fault. I know those things. But naturally, I have those feelings come up because I know I could have made an impact and changed the course of it. I felt so. But it was one of the biggest things for me to then release some of the shit off my chest that I was holding on to, because the things she was fearful of or shameful of or worried about, everyone goes through bullshit, man. But because the way that the media speak about you and put you on this thing and take you down, and then the consistency of everyone telling you all these same messages, man, it's tough at times not for it to get to your mental or your heart or any way, shape or form. I ended up on the Monday for 45 minutes talking in front of the boys. I burst. I was crying the whole time. I was a mess. I was releasing so much bullshit that I'd held on to, shit I hadn't really told people. And like, I then did a video and did the same thing because it was the only way I could get off this, my chest, this pain I was feeling.
How did the boys react to that?
You know what? Like, it's tough because some of the younger boys were like, oh, come and give me hugs. And some of the more boys I was a bit closer to did. But I also understand that seeing a man be so raw in emotion can also be quite uncomfortable for some people, man. So like, especially in England, like, you know, we're not a nation full of emotional intelligence in that way. And not through anyone's fault, but just the culture and the depression after the war that, you know, we get in this self-deprecating society here, which just doesn't really want you to reveal anything too much because you're going to get knocked down. And that's, you know, predetermined a lot by the media and how they behave and what they do to everyone. They knock down everyone they possibly can. So it gives a dark cloud over the whole country. But yeah, just stuff broke in me, man. And, you know, I went on a whirlwind, man, because like 6 weeks later, I found out my wife-to-be's pregnant. Like, but I was stuck in Malibu during COVID trying to just center myself and like train with the people I've been training to for years. So then I've got all these things going on, man. Like I'm dealing with a lot and now I know I'm going to be a dad and like all these things are happening. And, you know, it sent me on a path now to do the book I've done and to speak the way I want to speak. And I'm, you know, I've got a whole media tour coming up and I'm going to be speaking in front of daytime TV shows. I'm not going to censor one fucking thing I say, man. I might not curse if it's the morning, but because I don't need to swear to make my point.
Yeah,
I did then because I felt it was more powerful.
Yeah.
But through my experience of everything that's happened and the way that we're going in this country, like, it's the only thing I know to do is to say what I feel. And from my heart, I've always been like that.
Mate, man, it's just so cool to hear it. Obviously read in the book, but hear it from you face to face, and everyone gets opportunity to listen. But you speak about the low of the death and the high of your new relationship, the high of a baby on the way, and then that's all taken away from you. Like, mate, it doesn't get any harder.
Yeah, you know what, right? If it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have met the love of my life. Because as soon as I found out she was pregnant, I said, you know, no matter what, we need to tell each other 100% of the truth because we need to be the best parents for this kid.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm not censoring anything because it's not about me anymore. There's another life at play. I can't hold on to this thing that I'm holding on to for so long all by myself because there's another life at play. So, man, we had a messy 12 months, man. I broke down so much, told her so much that I've been holding on to, and, you know, she held space and it was, and we're here now. And like, I'm doing the same for her because she's going through what she's going through, and yeah, she's the most beautiful light ever, man. And it's just, you know, I find it's tougher for women to see who they truly are too, because the world is so judgmental in terms of physical appearance and it feels like such a big mountain to climb for them. So it's just always about letting her know how beautiful she truly is inside and out, because ultimately, you know, I just don't think our culture really allows for that.
And there's a bit of, in your book, around when you get married or you announce you're together, the amount of warnings she gets from previous partners. How hard's that for you to know that's all coming in, and how hard's it for her to go through all that as well?
Listen, yeah, my wife is a G, bro. Like, she handled it all like a G.
Yeah.
Like, she read it as if to be like, all of these women are saying all these things. Like, you must have something going on that's mad special. Like, she just saw it in a completely different way.
Yeah.
She handled it like a gangster. Didn't you, babe? When you would get a message from like hundreds of women.
Hundreds? Millions?
No,
millions?
I'm telling you now, I handled it like a G.
It was definitely 70,000.
It wasn't 70,000.
It was more than hundreds. Let's put it that way.
And they're the only ones who messaged you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, she handled it like a G, man, to be fair. Like, for me.
Yeah.
Watching the way she handled it was just fine for me, man. Like, I didn't expect anything less from her.
And talk to me about your plans going forward. Like, you're just sort of sitting in limbo now. You're about to do obviously your book tour, a lot of media coming up. What about on the footy field?
Oh, man, do you know what? The way I feel today, like, in my body right now, I've never felt this clear of mind, like, for the most elongated periods of the day. Like, I don't have those ups and downs, those moments. I'm committed to a frequency and energy state of joy, and I stay within it. Even if I say something that might come across quite harsh, if I say something about Eddie or these things that I tweet, it's from a loving place, but only from the experience. I'm never critiquing the man. I understand and have compassion for his journey, and being a young mixed boy in Australia, an awfully racist country, and growing up small and always being second choice, and you know, having a bit between your teeth, that's going to create some form of ferocity from your being, you know. Like, I understand that difficulty, but I also then don't accept certain behaviours. So, like I say, anyway, I'm in a complete state of joy, and if I was to play now, man, I think it would be the most amount of fun. Like, I'm playing football now every Monday and Wednesdays, and on Wednesdays it's a really high level. Like, some boys have played in the Prem and been pro and all that, and, mate, I'm loving it just as much as I was playing in front of 80,000 people. Like, just being locked in, like, using my skills, using my understanding, my awareness, and just pushing it to the test. But physically, I've never felt clearer of injuries and sharper. I'm 35 and I feel great. Whether it comes or not, I'm so cool with it. But if it does come, man, it'll be great.
Do you think you could play professional football?
Not now. I'm 35. Like, if I committed to it when I was, certain leagues I probably could. Like, I could play in Saudi. I probably won't get the big contracts. I'll be on pennies over there, but I'd be part of the squad. And I reckon, like, when I was 22, 23, if I committed, I could have played a high level, yeah.
Yeah. And what about cricket? How do you go at cricket these days?
I haven't played for ages. The last time I played, I was 18. I haven't played for 9 months.
Oh, true.
And I went to school with Jason Roy, you know, plays for England.
Yeah, yeah.
And they asked me to play because I was involved in lots of training for rugby. And I played a game. We played against, like, all these England junior bowlers. And me and Jay Roy, I got like 90-odd and he got 70-odd or something. Like, it was just so much fun. I got out to the worst late cut ever. Like, I remember it to the day. I was like, I should have got my 100. But anyway, yeah, I haven't played for a while. I will do this summer if an opportunity comes, for sure.
Yeah. And what about after you obviously finished either footy or rugby? Obviously, coaching must be a passion of yours, like hearing you talk, reading your story. You obviously love the game. I think you'd be a outstanding coach. Is that something you'd like to go down?
Like potentially. You know, I see a lot of pre-seasons over here get wasted and teams don't improve. They just do a lot of running and everyone gets great body compositions and people get fitter, but the knowledge, the understanding, the ability to attack space, take people on, and so on, doesn't necessarily improve in pre-season. Pre-season is the biggest time that you can do that. In 2 weeks, you can make a massive change in a group, like huge changes if you do the correct decision-making focused training. So I don't think, like, necessarily I want to be a full-on coach, like, not right now. I'd definitely consult. I'd go in and I would share and talk and get involved as much as I could. But I've got I don't know how it's going to look, but I know I just want to make a big difference, man, because I know I've been in my mind and I've been through the turmoil of a lot of things, and I live in a very joyous state, but only through being accountable and responsible for my actions. Yeah.
Could you see yourself coaching England? You probably didn't have the career you dreamed of as a player, but as a coach, man, how good.
Some of the stuff I've said about the RFU, there's no way they've got the bottle. Rugby in this country is like a giant sixth form. It's like people going, oh no, he swore. I can't bring him into my team. Like, come on, mate. Like, let's just be real. Open the lines. It's a sport. It's fun. It's joyous. Let's enjoy it.
Yeah.
It's not the be all and end all. Obviously, it's important. It's people's livelihoods. You give everything you can in that moment. You do everything you possibly can. Of course, it's why we're here. This is life. This is the life force of what we're doing. But you don't add on all this extra pressure and have to be seen. Like, let's be real with it, man.
Yeah.
And then the game over here would flourish. There's so many kids at this game that would be amazing for.
I guess unlikely England, but maybe another country.
Well, listen, one day, I'm not writing anything off. I completely never, ever in my life thought I was going to meet the most amazing woman, fall in love and be in love with one woman and never get my eye turned and never be in that position of just being completely loved and love someone.
Yeah.
I didn't think I was worthy of it.
Mm.
And I do now. And I do. I love her. She loves me. I'm worthy of it. All that stuff. To me, that was the biggest miracle ever.
Yeah.
'Cause I didn't see that in my forecast, in my future. So I know anything's possible, bro.
Yeah. Mate, what a story.
Nothing.
And I guess the way we finish this podcast most of the times is put out some questions to the Instagram. Millions came in for you, probably a lot of your girlfriends, et cetera, came in, and a lot of stories you wanted to know about. Okay, tell us the story about when you got hit by a bus.
Yeah, so pre-season, end of the year, had a terrible season at Sale. No other way to galvanize the group than to get pissed. So we all went to Leeds on a mad end of season jolly up or whatever it was. And I was about 7 hours deeper drinking. It was only 8 p.m. And I ran across the road, thought the bus was stopping. It wasn't. And it collided with me. But I'm here to tell the story and the bus isn't. So, you know. It is part of it.
Did it get rid off that bus? You absolutely.
It did. The pictures, they're on the internet, mate. Don't worry about it.
Did it hurt?
Man, not like, I was so pissed. And I got slightly concussed. And it might have given me a slight MCL grade tear, a one or two. But, you know, I live to tell the story. It was way more hurt than me, I'll tell you that.
What did the boys think? Did they think you were done, or like that must have been pretty scary on the piss?
Yeah, the boys, I think everyone was pretty scared because like people heard it from like down the road, just colliding with the bus, like poof. And then all the boys, there's a picture of all the boys in fancy dress around me, like in the papers. There's like Alice in Wonderland, the 6'5" Alice in Wonderland. There's like a 6'7" Tin Can Man or something, like some crazy shit, all just stood over me. It just was a comical moment, but yeah, I almost died. But yeah, I'm just so grateful that I'm here and I'm so happy that I get to live life.
Oh, that's good stuff. Well, you obviously smoked the bus, but another story everyone wants to know about is the Josh Lucy fight. Not sure if you smoked him as much.
I didn't. Do you know what? But listen, again, I got hit without knowing about it.
What did you do?
Sean was wanting me to like lead the group because at this point at Wasp, it was a little bit of a like, we weren't killing it like we normally are. I was like, wanted to get back into it. It's like, Danny, come get into him. I'm 20 and I'm like, normally I don't lead in that fashion. So I started remembering how Alex King would speak to people and he'd be like, fucking hell. So I tried to do the same. And Josh is renowned for being the worst trainer in the world. Like, he will throw 4 bad passes and then blame everyone else, like, and then walk off the field. He's done that before. Anyway, he's from the army. He's tough, macho fella. I'm only like 19, 20. And like before I know it, he's hit me. But now I'm 35. I can't imagine hitting a 19 or 20-year-old.
Yeah.
Like, but yet in England, everyone passed off as if I was the bad guy. Like, yeah, well, look, getting too big for his boots, cocky, like him, didn't it, mate? I'm like, as a 35-year-old man, for me to think about hitting a 20-year-old in a game training because he's maybe pushing buttons on my ego. Come on, man. We need a bit of growing up to do, fellas.
Yeah. Mate, that's so interesting. That's crazy.
Mate, there was a picture of me with a cut and everyone was like, yeah, he's getting his just desserts. Like, what the fuck, man? Like, at that age, I was like, yeah, fuck it, it's me. Like, I genuinely, and now I'm 35, I'm like,
yeah,
mate, this world's so far.
Yeah.
Like, do you know what? If it was a fair fight, Josh, I'd smug.
Rematch.
Hell yeah.
Okay, next one. Who's the best 10 in the world right now, in your opinion?
Richie Mwanga.
Is it? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I think I like the way he plays. I see when he's fully like in flow and not. I see the way New Zealand are back playing now, and it's great to see. I think their line out plays are slightly structured, and I know Joe Smith's got a role in that because he's probably tried to bring a bit of solidarity around the play and around their phase shape and around their counter attack. It seems like New Zealand are back to being what they are. From line out, I would say that they need to start pushing the boundary a bit because it's one of the best places to attack, like, really. But anyway, when I see Richie playing and he's like, especially for the Crusaders and also for NZ, yeah, he's got a good flow to him, man. For sure. I would say for all 10s, like, spin passing is important, but when you go to line, you've got the ball in a end-over-end style fashion, and you can play short or go out the back or go long with it.
Yeah.
You hold defenders for a split second more.
Yeah.
But a lot of fly-halves go with the spin pass. If you've got a spin pass at the line, I know you're going long or out the back.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just say manipulate the ball a little bit. I like the South African guy, Libuk.
Yeah.
I think he's got some nice feel to him. Yeah. I love Willie Libuk at 10, even though he plays 15. I love him stepping in. He's a top player. Yeah.
Yeah, nice options. It's going to be some World Cup, eh? Can't wait to see what happens.
Yeah, it is. Like, with you guys probably don't feel it. There's a lot of shit going on in this country regarding English rugby. But
I've heard a little bit, yeah. He's under the pump, eh, old Borthwick.
But in terms of the world game, it's going to be the best World Cup for a while, man.
Yes.
There's a lot of teams. Ireland, New Zealand, South Africa, France. England are always on their day. You don't know what you're going to get, man. I know right now it don't look great, but
even Scotland, eh, are going pretty good.
Scotland, can't write them off.
Finn Russell's a bit like Cipriani, similar.
He is. He's a bit more frivolous. He's a bit more frivolous and he's a bit more carefree. And I do love that element to him.
Yeah.
I had a period of that when I was younger, but I then was working heavily on my decision making. Like I was prided myself on making good decisions, but also being able to make the impossible pass in the moment too, which he can do. He just tries a bit more of than me.
Yeah. Fair.
At the latter part of my career. But yeah, Finn Russell's got magic, man. He's a serious player.
He can play. Okay, a couple more. Is it true Lindsay Lohan got in a fight over you?
Yes.
Was she? Just scrapping. Wanting the big dog back.
Yeah, they were just having a little tussle over old D-sit. That's what was going down, man.
What was that like for you? The boys must have given you a lot of shit for that sort of stuff.
Mate, I was in America. And there was just loads of paparazzi everywhere. It just didn't really seem like my life, but it was. It was funny, to be fair.
Yeah, do you look back at all these moments and think, far out, like, this has been some crazy, crazy life, like almost like it's not yours.
For real. Like, yeah. I'm 35 now. I don't dive into my memory lots. I don't really, like, I don't utilize it that much because I feel it. If I do, then I'm constantly going to be living in things that have gone on in the past and I can't be present. But if I sat down and think about things or someone says something that triggers something within me, then I remember that time and I'm like, far out. It does seem like so long ago, like so much stuff has gone on. But I'm so grateful for the whole journey of it. And, you know, I want the world to meet my wife because ultimately, I can't be a bad guy if I've married such an angel.
Yeah.
I haven't got enough.
Oh, love it. Okay, two more. Get him to say the story of when he had too many mushrooms.
Okay. God damn. That's in the book. I'm going to have to wait.
Yeah, you've got to leave something for the book, do you?
I've got to leave something for a bit of, you know, a bit of mystery. But yeah, it was a heavy experience, man. Like, I was seeking and searching a lot of my life. Like, from 24, I met an amazing mentor in Steve Black, and he taught me so much. And at that point, I started training in Malibu and training with a guy called Laird Hamilton, who's a big wave surfer, and meeting lots of you know, really special people who had different perspectives on lives, and they were introducing lots of different ways of healing, lots of stuff that was within me. And one of the things suggested that was going on was, you know, microdosing at a point later in my life. And I was always seeking and searching, and you know, at some point that falls away. Like in this current state, the way I feel now, it's not a necessity to go down that route. It's not a necessity to take psychedelics. It's not a necessity to do all that. But where I was at and where I was coming from, the thing that was driving me, the pain, the frustration, the trying to figure all these things out, it's a route I did go down, and it did ease and help some things for me. But some people don't have the most amazing stories around it. So I'm never advocating it or ever telling people what to do. But in the book, you'll find out the extent of that story.
Yeah, okay, nice little teaser. One more story, actually, I forgot about this one. This was Willie Hines mentioned this one, but he wanted to know the true story of the Jersey night out. He doesn't often go out with the boys, so this must have been a once-in-a-lifetime experience for him.
So what happened was we was in a nightclub in Jersey.
Yeah.
And Willie was outside, and I was going to go get him in. I had two drinks. I was going to hand him one, come in, little rum and coke, let's go. So I've gone out to, and the security's there, like, playing the role of security. Can't take drinks outside. And I was like, okay, cool. And then, like, they kind of put their hands on me a little bit, and I looked at him in the eyes, and I downed one and I downed the other, and I was like, can I go now? And he was like, cool. So I've gone outside to get him in. And then it's kind of just going. There's a bit of a fracas. No pushing and shoving, but for some reason we can't get back in now. And they're like doing, you know, keeping us away. And this like little the security guard is there, but then the manager's there, and he's probably about, I don't know, 5'8", 5'9", he's giving it big licks too. So I just lean over and like pull his tie, yeah. But it's a pull off tie. Oh, yeah. It's a pull down tie. He didn't even do a proper tie. Like, I've taken the tie. I've just put it in my pocket and I've walked off. That is the extent of what happened, right? Yeah. Within 60 seconds, police, because Jersey's a tiny little place.
Yeah.
There's only one nightclub there. There's a copper sitting waiting for people to get up to trouble. And, yeah, I'm then getting cut. They're trying to arrest me. So this is the only bit that I probably shouldn't have done was, as these two guys are trying to put my hands behind my back, I'm there going, why am I getting arrested? What have I done?
Yeah.
I'm asking them and they're not giving me an answer. So I push them both off me and I'm like, why am I getting arrested? And they won't give me an answer. But then I realise, I'm like, okay, you can't do that to the police. They're the law. Yeah. So I was like, okay, arrest me. But then they put the cuffs on so tight and put me down. And I went, my wrist's hurting. I can feel pins and needles in my hand. Can you loosen the cuff? Can you loosen the cuff? I'm telling him and he's not doing it. Right.
Yeah.
And then the Sun newspaper the next day have done a story saying that when I'm getting arrested and I'm getting handcuffed, I'm screaming, these wrists are golden, loosen the cuff. Like the shit that they come up with, man. Like, so then for the rest of that season, everyone's calling me golden wrists. I then go get player of the year being called golden wrists. So I'm kind of like, jokes on you, motherfuckers. You know what I mean? Like, so stupid. You set me up for it. Set me up for an outstanding season.
Oh, that is so good. Okay, last question. Best piece of advice you have for a Woodlad listener?
Best piece of advice would be to get a sense of the game for yourself. Like, listen to your coaches. But get a feel for what you're doing for yourself, because you are the only person on the field that can do it. If you are always following directives and orders, you're only ever going to be playing out directives and orders. You're always going to be slightly off the beat. Obviously, there's parts of the game you need to understand. The team's framework, the coach's vision, his views on leadership, how he conducts himself. Do it with respect, obviously. But in terms of learning yourself and your movement and your body on the field, go and express and have fun with that. Like, don't get rigid and tight, because over here we see people like catching forwards and running straight, and they look like little washing machines running forward. Like, there's no relaxation in their shoulders. So I just get a bit of movement and flow in it, and don't hype everything up to the contact of the game. The contact's coming. You're going to be fine. Like, you're going
to
be good.
Mate, what a way to finish. You've got to get into coaching. I would be wasted to not see you get into coaching at some point.
Mate, I coached from 2014.
Yeah.
2013 to 2020.
Yeah.
While I was playing. And I loved it. And every team I went to, you know, we outperformed. Well, we didn't outperform. The improvement spiked. The place in the table spiked. The efficiency of everyone's gameplay spiked. And that's got nothing to do with me. I'm not saying I did that. If you give a perspective in rugby over here, which is slightly different, it's really easy for the boys to dive into it and go and do it, because it's them that do it. It's the players that go and do it. Any coach that takes any responsibility or praise for it is an egotistical mofo. Like, you can give a directive or a verbal or information. As soon as that player plays well, you had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
You just sit back and enjoy. Like, enjoy what he does. And then that will keep your ego out of it. And then that will also keep you from giving emotional directives and giving clear and concise ones. That's how I feel.
Mate, 100%. And what a way to finish the podcast. Mate, I was super excited to have you on. And man, that has not disappointed. Like, you go through your story. There's obviously moments throughout it. It's hard not to feel sorry for what you've had to go through, but then to see you on the other side, so happy.
Wait, don't feel sorry for me for a second. I feel so strong internally because of everything I faced.
100%.
I'm unafraid to go and speak and say what I got to say now. Like, even if the world right now thinks I'm X, Y, and Z, no one knows what I'm like in these four walls, bar people that do speak to me.
Yeah.
And I know myself to the core now, whereas I used to get all my external validation outside from playing or people's views or opinions of me. I was a kid growing up. I didn't know no better. Now I do. I'm good. Your brother's a legend too.
He speaks very highly of you as well. So does Willie Hines.
Mate, I love how your brother, right, used to get a little bit tipsy. And he would just tell all these boys what he thinks about them.
He'd take them to the green room or something, would they call it?
Oh, mate, the green room. Mate, go to the back green room with Marshy, mate. But I loved that because it was like, this guy's just telling people what the fuck is up and what is apparent. Like, in England, they don't do that. We all dance with banter and dance around the circles. Like, he was just like, no, you're a dick because of X, Y, and Z. And it was normally right. And people were like, far out, man. Like, he was some sort of guru when he got in the green room.
The green room's a special place, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, Willie Hines is a legend too, man. His family's awesome. Yeah. Like, Tommy Marshall, Beth, like, they're just great people, man. I really enjoyed them when I was at Gloucester.
Hey, anyway, it's been awesome to have you on. Loved watching you as a player. Really appreciate you giving up your time and coming on. And anyone listening, make sure you go get a copy of this book. I honestly, hand on heart, say it is the best autobiography I've read. Just blew me away. I couldn't put it down. 2 days. I'm not even a big reader, and I've done it in 2 days. Oh, incredible.
Mate, thank you.
But no, I appreciate you coming on. You're a true legend.
No, mate. Give it my best.
Hey, guys, thanks for listening. And if you've got this far, I'm guessing you enjoyed the episode. So if you did, please give it a share if you can. And also, cheers to our mates at Spates for sponsoring this episode. What a lad, what a lad.